From the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. It's good, as always, to have you along, everybody. The United States is a pretty diverse place. It's often helpful for a lot of us to feel that we belong, to be attentive to patterns of injustice and supporting the needs of those of us with diverging abilities. These all have a fairly long history of aspiration in our broader society, and especially in the field of social work. Doesn't seem too new or too contentious on the surface. The COVID-19 pandemic, awarenesses of racial inequities in higher education, and the death of George Floyd and other violence directed at people of color all seem to coalesce in making issues of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, again, long familiar to social workers, issues of almost global interest and reflection. These influences fostered increased sensitivity to injustices, and DEI initiatives blossomed across the country. The road forward hasn't been smooth, and legislatively, in many parts of the country, the pushback and backlash is robust. Given all this, we wanted to talk with a long-standing foot soldier with history and expertise in this area. Fortunately for us, we had somebody handy. Dr. Keith Alford, Dean and Professor at the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, agreed to talk with us about his long-term experiences, both personally and professionally, in advancing and leading efforts to promote an understanding and application of DEIA values and principles. This conversation can be experienced as a kind of an introduction, but also a critical examination of DEIA efforts, their promise, perils, and some informed ideas to navigate the complex way ahead. Keith Alford, PhD, LISW, is Dean and Professor at the UB School of Social Work. Dr. Alford joined UB upon leading his long association with the Falk School of Social Work at Syracuse University, which concluded in his position as the first Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer there. Among many other accolades and achievements, he is the first African-American dean in the 90-year history of the UB School of Social Work. Dean and Dr. Keith Alford, welcome to Social Work. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, I know we chased you for a long time and we got you. Thank you. So again, thanks for doing the podcast. And before we move into our main topic today, I do this for almost everybody, but I'm always interested in how our guests found their way to social work. You know, in the intro, we heard about your career as, you know, you're a practitioner, an academic, a scholar, the first chief diversity officer, I believe, at Syracuse University, and the first African-American dean of the UB School of Social Work in its 90-year history.
That's right.
That's probably not how it all started. I'm curious, how did you find your way to social work?
Well, Peter, thank you for that question. I have to think about it because I've been a social work practitioner, social work academician, social work scholar for so many years, decades now, that this takes me back to my origins. But I actually believe it started during my undergraduate years, when I was actually a student in college and remembered the opportunity of engaging in what we would call an internship experience. At my particular undergraduate institution of Coker University, we did not have a social work major. We did have a sociology major with a concentration in social services. And I took advantage of that opportunity. And that concentration in social services allowed me the opportunity to do this abbreviated internship at the Darlington County Department of Social Services. That's really where I believe started my entree, if you will, into social work practice, and got my feet wet and really appreciated the opportunity to engage with the fellow social workers at that time. I believe they were called case managers at that time, but nonetheless, under that realm or umbrella, should I say, of social work. Now, we now know that it's so critical to make sure that there's a social work degree attached to any title of social work, right?
Yeah.
But nonetheless, those are, if I recall correctly, the early days of my entree into social work. But really, if you think about it, I have to kind of look at this as a part of who I am and my family experience as well, because we are all about engaging and connecting with people where I come from. And I'm originally from the South, and my family was a great influence. When I say family, I'm referring to my extended family as well as my immediate family, was a great influence on my upbringing. And so it was all about engaging and connecting with each other. Now, what does that mean for social work? It just means that we have to hear and engage with each other in order to learn from each other. And to me, all of those ingredients made me who I am and how I started in this wonderful profession.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Imagine that. That is going to lead right in, I think, to our topic in a lot of ways. And you're a former family therapist as well, as I remember this from previous conversations.
I am. I actually have a degree. My PhD is certainly in social work with a specialization in family therapy. Oh. And so I have a great deal of experience working as a mental health practitioner, serving families in the Columbus, Ohio area for a number of years. So you're exactly right.
All right. Terrific. And thank you for doing that. So are you ready to dive in here?
Yes.
All right. Social work and social work education has been in the diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility business for quite some time. I mean, in some ways, these are kind of baked into social work values. You know, just how effectively might be a topic for another podcast. We'll leave that maybe for part two. But and also, in many ways, you know, many in corporate America have also been on the record stating that DEIA is actually good for business in a diverse society. So these really are not new ideas. I think people talk about them as new ideas, but I don't think that's quite accurate. So social work is committed to the ecological perspective. So if we could, I'd like to start with that lens. So very brief here, history. Following the deaths of Trayvon Martin and George Floyd, DEI efforts were increased. Funding was attached to it, and programs seemed to gather a lot of momentum. I don't know if you would agree with this, but currently, we seem to be living in an environment that is now pushing back, to say the least. Detractors of DEIA efforts conflate initiatives and commitments with, let's see here, indoctrination, unfairness, anti-whiteness, anti-Semitism, and even racism. Mm-hmm. You and I are speaking in May of 2024. And legislation limiting or banning DEI initiatives and funding have been introduced in 25 states, and in 8 of those, they've become law. Members of the U.S. Congress brag about their success in taking down educational leaders of our universities. Claudine Gay, the first Black president of Harvard, on the job, I think, for about 6 months, no longer has that job. So let's talk about DEIA over this conversation. You know, where are we? How are we doing? And finally, and most practically, what can we do as social workers, social work educators, and as people to move forward? So I know that was a mouthful. I've tried to give you lots of bait. Feel free to take whatever you'd like. And I just wonder if you'd like to comment on that kind of characterization.
Peter, you've said a lot and certainly do want to comment. I have a lot of comments that I want to share, but I want to probably start out by saying that diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, those are terms that we first need to understand their definitions. Yeah. We need to appreciate the fact that, yes, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, DEIA, This is not new. This is actually a piece that, if we want to, we can trace it back to the Civil Rights Act, where in that particular act, the outlawing of discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, natural origin, and so many more, right? That mm-hmm. was really a watershed moment for our country. Now, keep in mind, though, so much has taken place since that time. And I'm referring to, of course, the 1960s. Nonetheless, we needed a focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. We needed to appreciate, should I say, that it is a multicultural society that we live in, not a one race society or one cultural society. It's a multicultural society. So an appreciation for multiculturalism, an appreciation for the lived experiences of others is really what I believe sits at the core of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And so when we say diversity, in my opinion, Peter, diversity is really an appreciation of so many different elements, right? Race, identity, positionality, a number of elements that make up diversity, even neurodiversity, right? Mm-hmm. We have to be mindful that it's not just a term in and of itself. It's a term that is, I would say, replete with a number of different elements. Equity is not equality, while equality is certainly critically important. But equity says, I want to really make sure that I understand your lived experience in terms of what you need, what resources you obviously will benefit from if you had them at your disposal. Mm-hmm. What are the pieces that will help move the equation forward for you? We're talking about equity versus, and maybe I shouldn't use the term or the word versus. I actually should say equity and equality. But I know that oftentimes we use those two words interchangeably. So I wanted to make sure that I distinguish, in my opinion, the difference. And then inclusion really is about belonging. We can certainly talk about having folks at the table, but once they're at the table, are we making sure that their voices are heard? Are we making sure that we hear where they're coming from? So inclusion has a great deal, in my opinion, to do with belonging and making sure that everyone feels connected, involved. And of course, when we talk about accessibility, that's an elevation for an appreciation of the lived experiences of people with disabilities and making sure that we are really doing our part to address how we are engaging, how we are even performing, if you will, relative to all that we do so that people with disabilities, whatever those disabilities may be, are fully embraced and they are fully appreciated around their needs as well. So I wanted to make sure that I talk about the definitions of those terms associated with DEIA. Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I actually just wanted to interject because I think this is something, and just hanging around with you, this is something that I've just noticed, is that lots of folks talk about DEI. I hear that term all the time.
Right, right.
When I hear you talk about DEI, you always say A.
Yes, I do. And sometimes there's a raised eyebrow when I do that, but I always feel like that's my opportunity to explain.
Yeah. And I don't know if I have a raised eyebrow. It's just noticeable. You're just consistent. You just never let it go by without adding the A. I can tell you feel strongly about it.
I do feel strongly about it. And Peter, if you don't mind my digressing, although it's really connected to this very piece. And I think it is okay in this particular case for me to share this personal experience of the fact that, yes, I am a Black man and I am a Black father of a son with disabilities. And so when I think about DEIA, I can't help but think about the fact of my own lived experience as a father caring for an adult, young adult mm-hmm. son who has disabilities, who I'm extremely proud of be able to manage in this world, given every challenge that he has faced. And so keep in mind, oftentimes when we think about DEIA, we're thinking about it in this kind of global sense, but there are personal stories to everyone. And particularly in my lived experience, there are personal stories that I think elevate and that characterize what DEIA really stands for. And so when you talk about the A that I add to DEI, I add it oftentimes thinking about my son, but also appreciating and wanting to pay honor, if you will, to the disability community.
Yes, absolutely. And as long as we're doing stories here, I'll do it myself. As an able-bodied person, and as a white person, I am used to walking around in a world that's largely built for me. And I'm not so proud of saying this, but I didn't become acutely aware of accessibility issues until my father became elderly and wanted to move around in the world, unsteady on his feet. And I began to notice all of a sudden all the obstacles that I just walked by every single day.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't have to be that way, obviously, but I think that's what it took for me. So, yeah. So everything that you talked about, I think you had another thought before I jumped in. So yeah,
I just wanted to say, I appreciate you sharing that story about your father, because what you just did, Peter, at least as I received it, is to engage in what I believe we need to do more of, is this whole idea of sharing commonalities, sharing experiences that are similar or at least in the same arena as the other, so that we can fully appreciate where the other is coming from. And so I was able to share a story about my son briefly, and you were able to share the story about your father. And so I felt, again, yet another connection.
Yeah, same. Thank you. So everything that you talked about, you know, your descriptions of DEIA and where it came from and really what it's all about. I mean, honestly, on the surface, there's not a lot to argue about there. You would think, right? I mean, we're on a pretty small planet with a lot of different people. That seems okay. We should get this. We can all rally behind this. But of course, that's not really, I think, the planet that we're living on yet.
No.
So let me just ask, you addressed this, but I want to see if we can fine tune it a little bit. Why should we promote and argue and value? What's in it for us to value DEI? Why should we do it?
I mean, we should do it because we are social workers that believe in a value base. And that value base says that we should not only appreciate, but do our best to enforce the dignity. And I say enforce in the most endearing way. But enforce the dignity and worth of humankind. And when we think about that, we have to think about that from a place of humanity, a place of DEIA. And you referenced earlier, Peter, that this is an easy concept. This is really, you know, part and parcel of who we are. But yet there is a concern on the part of many that this is not how it should be. We are one nation. We are one sovereign country. Okay, I hear you. While at the same time, every family has family traditions. Every culture or cultural group has a culture that they can reference in terms of customs and mores and the like, right? Why should we dishonor those because of who they are? We actually should celebrate those and look at opportunities to engage even more. When we know that there are diverse opinions at the table, then in my opinion, solutions are just around the corner. Actually, solutions are pretty much in front of us, because we will get so many different ways of coming at a situation or a problem area. So it makes sense, in my opinion, and certainly as social workers who value the worth and dignity of the person, who value the worth and dignity of humankind, it makes sense that we appreciate diversity, equity, and inclusion. So all of this legislation that's occurring in states repealing DEIA, all of the above, I got to tell you, it's disheartening, but I'm not daunted by it. I am a firm believer, and I even said this, particularly when I think about what took place here in our own city of Buffalo, New York, on May 14th, 2022. 10 Black lives were snuffed out simply because they were going to a grocery store shopping for groceries, engaging in what we all do every day, right? But it was a calculated plan to target this particular supermarket because it was in the Black neighborhood, or the Black section, if you will, of Buffalo. And I mentioned that from the standpoint that, yes, we have to be mindful that if we are not appreciating diversity, equity, and inclusion, if we're not understanding that we live in a multicultural society, and if we also are not understanding that there is a centrality of whiteness, there is a feeling that individuals are inferior, some in reference to race, sexual identity, sexual orientation, any number of elements, if you will, of diversity, then we're actually doing ourselves a disservice. We have to recognize that those unfortunate parts of our society still exist, while at the same time, we can't be daunted by it. I've said this before, and I even said it at the commencement address in 2022, which was 1 week after that racially fueled massacre here in Buffalo. I said that racism is alive, but it will not thrive. It will not thrive, Peter, because we won't let it as social workers. We won't let it as humanitarians. We will need to do our part to make sure that we are acknowledging and engaging and actively looking at ways that we can address inequities in our policies, in our practices, in our curriculum, all of the above. Because that is how we can move forward as a society. One of the things I got to be careful is that I can go on and on and on. So you feel free to interrupt. Please, please.
No, I think we're going to revisit those themes over the course of our conversation. But Dean Alford, I am going to invite you into the hornet's nest here.
Yeah, and please, Peter, call me Keith.
All right. I will. Thanks. So the hornet's nest for me is that I know you have a clinical background. We'll just hedge it in that way. But what do you think folks are so afraid of? Why is this tearing us apart rather than making us closer, more conversational, more accepting? What do you think? I guess I'm making an assumption. What do you think folks are afraid who oppose these programs? And what do you think they're afraid of?
Well, that's a very good question. I think for me, Peter, I don't know whether I would use the word afraid. I guess
okay.
That is probably a way to look at this. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like we have to be mindful that history speaks for itself. And when we think about our indigenous brothers and sisters and individuals who clearly have been here long before any of us have been here, and what they had endured, when we think about so many groups who have been marginalized throughout history, certainly as we know, the enslavement of Black people, and now with the rise of anti-Semitism, it is continuing to be more and more of a concern that groups, people who want to live their lives in this country, are Muslim, friends, brothers, sisters, the number of incidents that we can pinpoint that are still incidents of hatred and even violence is enough for us to say, is this who we are? Is this who we want to be? Regrettably, history tells us that, yes, this is how it has been. But you and me and so many others, we have to still stay the course. We have to continue to move the needle forward because it won't thrive. These efforts will not thrive. While they are certainly gaining momentum, No question about it. But in the long run, they won't thrive because we know that it is about humanity. It is about doing the right thing. It is about, if I go back to our value base as social workers, competence, you know, service, integrity. Those are values that we hold dear, and those are the values that we have to continue to infuse. So someone might say, well, Keith, that sounds so, you know, pie in the sky, but it's actually not. Because if we're intentional in our efforts, if we're doing what we need to do on a daily basis and being upfront about issues of race, being upfront about the fact that trauma is occurring on a daily basis, then we're also working simultaneously to counteract that. I hope that makes sense. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, I think it makes sense. And thank you for even kind of taking that question on. I know that that was probably not easy, like much of this isn't.
No, it's not. But I appreciate the question.
You know, what I want to do is I want to see if I can get you to help us understand your thinking and I think even probably give us some practical ideas about if we want to be allies, how to do this. How do you think about and respond to positions taken against DEI programs? And when folks argue that these programs and what they represent, they argue that they are racist, which I think that takes some interesting thinking. And they create a system where basically it reduces people to oppressors against the oppressed, that these programs are exclusionary. And of late, here in May of 2024, have triggered a rise in anti-Semitism around the country and especially on college campuses. How do you respond to those kind of arguments?
Thank you, Peter. I think for me, it's important to first, hopefully, be able to frame whatever the discussion may be at that moment and with whomever that individual is or group may be, to frame it as a dialogue versus a debate. Because oftentimes in these situations, as you clearly indicated in terms of the views around DEIA and that it's pitting individuals against each other or it's even racist in and of itself, which I totally find one of the biggest falsehoods out there, right? If I can just say that. But when it's pitted in that way, or when it's framed, should I say, in that way, it's framed almost like a debate. And I'm concerned that when you are debating, while I understand debate has a place in our society, when you frame it in that particular manner, then it becomes very problematic, because then we lose the possibility of really anyone gaining on both sides, right? Because it's all about winning. And there's in debate, there's a winner and then there's a loser. But in dialogue, everybody grows. Everyone grows in dialogue. And the opportunity then for me is that I would want to frame these conversations if I have the opportunity, and I will take the opportunity whenever those possibilities present themselves. But frame it as a dialogue so that I begin to help and share. And even in my role as an academician, and in this case, as a leader or administrator, to frame it from the vantage point of let's learn together, right? And so when I think about the benefits of DEIA, they are just enormous. And I'm not sure if everyone, particularly those who are naysayers, and that's actually putting it mildly, right? Those who are naysayers, I'm not sure if they understand the benefits. And I'm not sure if they fully appreciate the fact that better health outcomes are associated when there's a focus on DEIA, because we already know that there are certain communities that are in need of certain areas of growth around understanding what this means to actually care for myself and to care for my family from a health perspective. Social determinants of health have taught us, right, that we need to zero in on those areas so that we can fine tune and elevate the communities in need. Other outcomes we know that decision, I've already alluded to this earlier, that decisions, particularly when there is a diverse group of people at the table, decisions are that much more, I think, beneficial, and if I can use the word fruitful, from the vantage point that we have so many opportunities to hear different sides and different ways of coming at whatever the situation, whatever the problem or whatever the conundrum might be, right? Mm-hmm. Just as important, we are able to address racial and social injustices by way of DEIA programs or DEIA initiatives. Mm-hmm. We know that we live in a society where injustice, unfortunately, is happening on a daily basis. If we're not tuned into that from this space of DEIA, in other words, appreciating the fact that there are so many inequities out there, they are also in attention to diversity issues, then we're going to ignore the injustices that take place. We can't do that. We have to be on the front lines, if you will. So mm-hmm. I just see that there are so many benefits. And yes, I'm coming from my own space here, but mm-hmm. I would also come from the space of educating and yeah. trying my best to engage in dialogue so that we all grow.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I recall that before I even knew you were a candidate to come to UB, I was reading about you.
Yeah. I'm afraid to ask, what were you reading, Peter?
I'll tell you. Should have warned you about this part. I was reading, you know, in the Usual Suspects. I was reading in Inside Higher Ed and the Chronicle of Higher Education. And I was coming across, I don't remember exactly what was going on at the time, but you were at Syracuse. And I kept reading about like, what, you know, Syracuse is kind of like our neighbor here, you know, in Buffalo. We know Syracuse. We like Syracuse. You know, we like their basketball team and all that kind of stuff. I remember there was some kind of tension. I believe there might have even been some incidents on campus. And I kept reading about the chief diversity officer. And I just thought, oh, God, oh, he's in the article. He's brand new, relatively brand new. And Dr. Keith Alford. And you kept being characterized as this kind of like earnest, patient, collaborative presence. You know, they kept quoting you, and I thought, hey, this guy sounds like somehow he's walking that razor's edge through this likely very difficult situation. And I, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but then I remember reading about a shift, and then it seemed like all of a sudden things started being person-centered mm-hmm. rather than system-centered. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like things got weird and the wheels kind of came off. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I know you've been at this for a while. And
yes, absolutely.
It's probably not too much that scares you at this point.
Well, guess that would be one way to say it for sure. But yes, I do remember that time, and I am so honored to have served at Syracuse University as the School of Social Work director, mm-hmm. as well as the first chief diversity and inclusion officer. And you're exactly right.
Yeah.
There was that time where there were some incidents on campus that we had to fully address, while at the same time, as you well know, in any situation, it can move in various points throughout the process, right? And that's exactly what happened mm-hmm. with the student protests that were occurring at that time. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that I do remember about that, and the one piece that I want to pull from that and actually talk about it in reference to what we are addressing right now, is the fact that I was able to really hang in and stay the course and mm-hmm. really do my best to make sure that I was in that moment at that particular time, right? And not run away or skirt any responsibility or even the possibility of our students feeling at that time, mm-hmm. feeling that they did not have someone that can at least hear where they're coming from, whether they believe that person was hearing them authentically or not. Mm-hmm. That's the piece that I think is still critical today in terms of not only my work in the DEIA space, but also what I try to convey in my position as Dean of UB University at Buffalo School of Social Work, of which I am so very honored to serve in our 90th anniversary year. I want to make sure that we're always in the moment, that we're trying our best to work through and address so that our efforts are intentional. We have to think about the fact that all of us in this DEIA space serve as orchestrators, we serve as catalysts, and we also serve as transformers. Mm-hmm. So at any given time, we could be orchestrating, pulling folks together, trying to address whatever the matter may be, while at the same time, we have to continue to be the catalyst to keep it moving forward as best as possible and do so as collectively, hearing the voices of everyone, hearing the stories of everyone, and then be transformative or transformational in our thinking because we want whatever the situation is to improve, to ameliorate, to actually be better, right? So to me, that's transformation. So that's what I was able to take away from that experience and still utilize today here at UB School of Social Work.
Thanks. If we could, let's stay in kind of like the university educational, even social work educational setting for a second. If you're going to talk about these kinds of issues out loud, it's a fair bet that some people are going to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And also, in that kind of discussion, there are going to be people at the table who say, oh God, I think about this every day. Mm-hmm. This is the story of my life. I don't have a choice. Do I have to sit here and listen to this like this is some kind of new idea? And that this is something, you know, that we're brave to talk about. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, I feel that sometimes in my classroom, quite frankly. And I think I want to say something and just have you react.
Sure.
Universities, if they're going to do what they do best, mm-hmm. we can't promise all of our students that they will be comfortable at all times.
No. No, we cannot.
How much discomfort do you think is a part of learning? And maybe even just to go even further, can you learn without being uncomfortable to a certain extent? How much discomfort is a part of the learning process from your
point of view? I hope a great deal of discomfort.
Okay.
I hope a great deal of discomfort is a part of the learning process, Peter. And I hope that answer didn't throw you off in any way because.
No, I like it. I didn't think you were going to say it.
Yes. Simply because when we are in this kind of space of, I'll even use the analogy of this kind of knot or ball in our belly, right? Then that means that we might possibly be growing, that we actually might be moving from a space of this mm-hmm. kind of status quo to a new space beyond the comfort zone, right? And that's where we want to move in terms of our appreciation for race and how race plays such a pivotal role in our society. You know, I am reminded of the phrase that says, in order to be trauma-informed, you have to be racially informed. And that is so true, right? So we have to be uncomfortable, but let's also look at that kind of discomfort in a way of growth and also in a way of how do we then capitalize, and I'll use that phrase in a general sense, or term, if you will, in a general sense, on that so that we now can use it in a proactive way, right? And so to me, that's what education is all about. Now, I am not a proponent of someone feeling that they have been treated poorly, I say in a classroom experience or in a mm-hmm. in a group setting,
yeah,
or in a large meeting, you know, singling that person out. But I am someone who believes that, yes, let's talk about the ouch that may have occurred in the room. Let's mm-hmm. talk about, something doesn't feel exactly where it should be. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can go any further until we address that. Mm-hmm. To me, those are those teachable moments. Those are those opportunities where growth occurs that you just cannot make up. You have to just take advantage of it and move forward, right?
Yeah. And if I could just insert myself into your response here, you know, you just lit a light bulb above my head in terms of, and in this context, the person standing in front of the room, including me, sometimes gets humbled and is wrong, and if you will, or limited, let's put it that way. And I think needs to own that and apologize. And that is
very true. That is very true.
Well, it's not pleasant. It's humbling, but I'm learning more and more, even at this point, that it's helpful because it sets the stage for the next conversation, that it's possible that people can disagree and maybe even cause certain levels of discomfort. But if it's genuine and earnest, people are very forgiving in general. And that's what gives me hope sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If I could just keep on this, because relatively recently, you and I both attended a panel discussion on DEI here at UB. I believe there was a university representative there, somebody from the community, and one of our students. And in that conversation, fear was raised quite a bit. And I'll put this in quotes, DEIA phobia were mentioned. And one comment that really struck me that I want to ask you about was the statement that one of the limitations of DEIA efforts in educational settings was a tendency to transfer responsibility for implementation and follow through regarding DEI efforts to students. While at the same time allowing systemic problems to continue to exist and to not have to bear the responsibility and maybe even the effort. You and I didn't have a chance to talk after that. I wanted to ask you what you thought. What were you thinking? If that sounds familiar to you, those statements, what do you think about that?
Let me say this, Peter. Thank you for posing that. And again, this is going to be a statement that I think is critically important to unpack. Racism is a function of our society. And when I think about the fact that we live with the isms, if you want to refer to that, racism, sexism, heterosexism, ageism, we live with those on a daily basis, right? And I know that if we are not intentional in terms of our efforts to address those systemically in our own systems, policies, our practices, as a school of social work, I'll just utilize our own decanal unit as an example, then we're not doing what we need to do in terms of being good stewards of the profession, right? So absolutely, we should have committees. We should have, actually every committee should have a lens of trauma-informed care in terms of how we engage and communicate and understand trauma in the lives of the people and even our own interactions with each other. At the same time, an appreciation for, and not only an appreciation, but I would say an inculcation of diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility with respect to how it's played out in that committee's function, in that program's function, in that particular unit's function, so on and so forth. So that helps, if you will. Does it solve? No, but it helps get at some of the systemic pieces that are always present for us. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our society is ever changing. Our society is ever growing. So we have to always have these processes, if you will, in place. That's a given. And then the other piece, too, in terms of addressing this fear factor, we're social workers, Peter. We got it. We understand the competencies of reflective listening, of validation of feelings, of even effective use of silence, right? We understand how to utilize those in a way that will dismantle fear, that will dismantle this sense of, oh, I don't think I can go there. Social workers are the ones on multidisciplinary teams that will be able to address this better than most, simply because we do come at it from this ecological systems perspective and the appreciation of those, what I refer to as foundation skills and competencies that can be utilized at the macro level as well as the micro level.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah. Lots of thoughts listening to that.
I don't know if you can hear that I am a social worker and DEIA and trauma-informed care lens perspective thinking person. And that's where I'm coming from in my answers.
Yeah, absolutely. And forgive me for this, but to keep harping on it, and I'm kind of struck by a couple things in the here and now. We're doing a podcast. We're talking about DEIA. You're a Black man. I'm a white man. It reminds me of a quote that I think it might have been Toni Morrison. I'm not positive. I remember when we were still fresh on the heels of George Floyd's murder. Yeah. And I believe it was interviewing Toni Morrison. And she was kind of distraught in the moment. And finally, at the end of her comments, she said something to the effect, you know what? I'm kind of tired of this. Mm-hmm. This is not my problem. Mm-hmm. And I think she might have said, I think very directly, you know, this is a white person's problem. And when I heard that comment at that panel that you and I were about, that the DEI efforts have a tendency to fall on students, I think what wasn't said, that is part of my experience, that responsibility seems to disproportionately fall on the shoulders of students who are not white.
Mm-hmm.
And I also read recently that...
And I apologize for interrupting you, but to that point, we can't put, or we should not put students in a space or a place right. of having to defend or feeling like they have to explain when in fact they are the ones who are living and breathing this experience of living in a racially conscious society on a daily basis, right? So we have to be mindful of what Toni Morrison has said, but so many others have said that the responsibility lies with the adults in the room. And yes, lies fully, if you will, in terms of our ability to be able to communicate that, whether we're white or Black. But I do appreciate the fact that you, and you've said so in terms of your own work, Peter, as a white male, believe that it's important for you to be that person to say, yes, let me own this and figure out a way to address this. And even if I don't know the answer, I'm going to come back and let you know later as best as possible. Right.
Yeah.
And to me, that's earnest and that's authentic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard what you said loud and clear about we shouldn't put students in that situation where they have to be the voice and always the representative of the ideals or the aspirations. But I've also recently read that half of all diversity officers in universities in the U.S. are African American, and 2/3 of them are women.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts? Comments?
Well, it's interesting because as you were sharing those statistics, I almost wanted to switch roles and be the interviewer.
Yeah, yeah.
And say, well, what do you think about that?
Let's do that. That's fair.
Because, you know, I think at this juncture for me, and I would like to hear your thoughts for sure, no question about it. But for me, each diversity officer, each person in these leadership roles, particularly if they are charged, if you will, with carrying out and making sure that DEIA is understood as the ethos of their organization, they have to also come at it from their lived experience. And so this may be the opportunity then that they share, not in a sense of trying to receive support for themselves, but share their personal experience or their lived experience in a way that it is an education, while at the same time respectful of what could be a commonality or even a transferable piece for other groups who are in a similar situation or a similar background or from a similar background, so on and so forth. So I don't necessarily see that there is this large percentage of African American or people of color, if you will, serving as diversity officers as negative. I actually see that as positive, and certainly women serving in that role as well. It's an education, but keep in mind, this is a point in time. And so we have to still continue to do our best to fight for these roles to be maintained. Yeah. What I am hoping that over a period of time, we will see more expansiveness of how we understand what the role of diversity officer really means, or should I say DEIA officer really means, while also appreciating the fact that whoever is in that role, whether he, she, or they may be Black, white, Latinx, indigenous, Asian, whatever their racial background may be, we appreciate their lived experience. We appreciate their uniqueness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. And, you know, I think your turnaround back to me, I think, was fair. And I want to do that. I'm asking you to take a lot of chances here. And I think it's entirely fair. And I think what I think of it is partly buried in the observation and the question, especially on the heels of what you said earlier, of what I think about it. Specifically, it seems to me like an incredibly double-edged sword, where the person in the position is really, they can't win. You know, it is great that they are in these positions of influence and leadership. And I think for them to draw on their lived experience is crucial and probably a main part of a role in the job. And yet what I see is when they do it, and somebody doesn't like it, all of that is used against them to discredit them. And I think that's what I walked away with watching what went down with Claudine Gay.
Yeah.
You know, the people in Congress were looking for ways to trip her up and to discredit her. They wouldn't let her talk. I watched the hearings. And what was she cautious? Did she equivocate? I thought she did. But what else was she supposed to do in that context? Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you know, then there's all this stuff about plagiarism that I think was just window dressing for they wanted to get her. Anyway, so that's my answer, is that I just am sensitive to how almost you can't win. And maybe people like me need to step up more and to be supportive and to be the voice at the table rather than the person who is led around by people at the table, I guess. But thanks. Yeah.
No, thank you for sharing. I appreciate your points of view and how you were able to share that so genuinely. When I think about it, you're exactly right, Peter. For individuals, and you referenced, of course, Claudine Gay, which again, when I think about all that took place in that experience you know, I have to sit back and say, wow, she is still standing. She is still moving forward. It did not defeat her. She was not defeated. Mm-hmm. However, when I think about her and I also think about others like her, this pattern is all too familiar, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So your point is certainly well taken. But also, to your point, there needs to be support for leaders of color. There needs to be built-in mechanisms that actually support leaders of color so that their approach, their style is understood as just as real and authentic as the next person and credible, right? As opposed to being questioned that their style approach is not this, that, or the other, right? Mm-hmm. I am a collaborative leader. I do check in with folks. I come from an Afrocentric perspective in that way because it is about survival of the tribe. It is about the interconnectedness and the mutual aid that we all share. So I'm sure that, you know, it may be questionable for some in terms of my approach, but nonetheless, I have seen dividends. I've seen growth as a result, while I've also appreciated the fact that I've remained true to myself. But there needs to be support for leaders, Black leaders, Indigenous leaders, Latinx leaders, LGBTQ plus leaders. There needs to be support for diverse leaders so that they feel that they have kind of this ongoing affinity group that frankly believes in them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a whole nother piece in terms of affinity group affiliation and how those have been so helpful in the whole DEI space. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there are the critics out there. Don't get me wrong. I know they are. But I can attest to how that has not only fortified leaders of color, it has also helped organizations, institutions of higher education move in a forward direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. We are getting kind of close to our goal in terms of time.
We haven't finished, though. We have so much more, right?
I really do want to wrap this up in a nice, tidy package, you know, and then we won't have to talk about it anymore, and it'll be great. But I do want to leave out a chunk of time, and you've done this along the way. You've done this, but I really want to make it like super explicit here at the end, because I think we need to talk about how to move forward and how to be practical. And so we've covered a lot of ground here, and I know you to be a dedicated, optimistic, committed person who's prepared to play the long game when it comes to all of the issues we've been talking about. So I'd love to just spend some time and giving you one more chance to either amplify or to come up with new ideas to talk specifically about the role of our profession and also the role of social work education in acting in accordance with our values and our ethics. So when it comes to DEIA and our profession and social work education, what do you see as the way forward that you, maybe you haven't talked about or you want to talk about some more, especially given that we might be in a period of, you know, pretty robust pushback?
Absolutely. We have to make sure, and this is certainly a part of our EPOS competencies in terms of, you know, the Council on Social Work Education, we have to make sure that we are constantly attending to anti-racism and what that means, right? We know that there are a number of resources that are still available to organizations, to institutions of higher education, but social work, our profession, we actually, the National Association of Social Workers, we have a website that is replete, I believe, with a number of valuable resources that we can utilize to help us in our individual as well as collective efforts. Oftentimes, we're kind of in the mire of whatever we're doing, and we may not necessarily see that we have what we have in front of us that could be of value. But there are outside organizations like the NAACP and Anti-Defamation League, any number of organizations, entities, if you will, that can partner with us in our efforts to move forward. So again, as a social work profession and also as schools of social work and higher education, let's partner with others. Let's engage in that effort to coalesce so that we can utilize best practices going forward. To me, that's part and parcel. The research is available to us. We have a number of scholarly articles, studies that have been done that we can utilize that will help us in the process as well in all of our efforts. Let's use those, right? I know I may sound like I'm repeating myself, but it's one of those pieces where, Peter, we end up talking in these various meetings and we're scratching our heads and we say, wait a minute. You know, the answers are there. We just need to tap those answers, right? and support each other in the process. But we have to maintain intentionality in everything that we do and not be afraid to call it what it is, while at the same time saying this is how we're going to address it going forward, so that the kind of tiptoeing is not tiptoeing. It's actually really saying, hey, this is what I see, or this is what I've experienced, this is what I've been made privy to, so that we can move the needle forward. You know, racial trauma is omnipresent, right? As a Black man, I'm constantly reminded that every day when I wake up and I look in the mirror, I see my Black identity. I'm very proud of my Black identity. I embrace my Black identity. While at the same time, I also come to a predominantly white campus and realize that, I might have to engage a little differently here or engage a little differently there. I choose that. Other people may not choose that, right? Understanding and appreciating the dual socialization that so many people of color engage in, is also important. And what does that mean? Some may say, well, it's just part of life. Others, it will require them to kind of think twice. Do we appreciate this kind of back and forth that occurs and how that plays out also in the workplace? So I just believe that if we can maintain this mindset of intentionality in terms of calling it what it is, while at the same time making sure that we put programs and processes in place to address systemic issues, as well as engage in the individual one-on-one connectivity, that dialogue that I talked about earlier, that is, I think, the beauty of how we can move forward. Because appreciating the lived experiences of the other is really what social work practice is all about.
Thanks. I have one more for you. Well, actually, I'll ask two. If I could ask you a somewhat personal question. You strike me as an incredibly optimistic person. What keeps you optimistic, especially when it comes to the ideas and aspirations of DEIA? How do you do that?
Well, my answer may be viewed as rather simplistic. So
I'll take it.
I'm just going to give it to you. What keeps me optimistic is that every day is a new day. And I'll be able to wake up again tomorrow and start over again and hopefully do it better than the day before. I could elaborate, but I think that...
But I don't know why you would. I mean, I think I like to see things in the most practical way, and that sounds pretty practical to me.
Thank you, Peter.
I kind of satisfied a lot of my own curiosity in talking with you today. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would want to address here before we say goodbye.
Thank you for that opportunity. We covered a great deal, while at the same time, there's so much more that could be said as well, as you well know. I guess for me, being able to talk about the fact that there is a multicultural appreciation that we still need to have, but also, what does that appreciation mean? To me, it's inculcation in terms of understanding the lived experiences of the other, and also appreciating the fact that there is this kind of centrality of whiteness that exists in our society that we have to be mindful is a piece that, if we don't pay attention to, we can view everything from this lens of what would be viewed as normative, white normative, versus, and again, maybe I should say, in addition to appreciating what I might experience from my racial background, from my cultural background, and what someone else might experience from his, her, or their cultural background, their racial background. So we have to understand that it is not a one size fits all. And I think the other piece too is that you were so poignant at the very outset of this interview, Peter, by acknowledging and calling out the names of Trayvon Martin and of George Floyd. But I am reminded of Breonna Taylor. I'm reminded of Ahmaud Arbery. I'm reminded of Walter Scott. I'm reminded of so many other names that we did not call, unless we forget those individuals and their lives, and also what we have to do in terms of carrying on a legacy of uplift, while at the same time, a legacy that says we will continue to work so that racism does not thrive. It is alive, but it will not thrive.
Dean Keith Alford, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us. There are probably more reasons to avoid this conversation as a recorded one than to do it. And I, for whatever it's worth, I'm really grateful and I'm really glad to have the opportunity for our show to give a platform to hear people talk about your point of view and your ideas. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me, Peter, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Dr. Keith Alford for joining us. The In Social Work podcast team is an optimistic and hopeful mix, including Steve Sturman, our tech and web guru, our GA production assistant, guest coordinator, and audio editor, amongst many other things, Nick DeSmet. Say hi, Nick.
Hey, everybody.
And I'm Peter Sabota. Thanks for listening to our show, and we'll see you next time, everybody.